Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, Damen und Herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town.
It's time for the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Gonna make this kind of quick today, ladies and gentlemen, because there is a bee somewhere in this room, and I do not know where it is at this moment. So real quick, as I said, update and reminder from the Sundress Academy for the Arts in Knoxville, Tennessee. This Saturday, I mentioned this on episode 58, and I will mention it again for you right now here on 59. This Saturday, September 3rd, from 2 to 8, Sundress is celebrating the raising of its barn. In other words, a barn-raising party of barbecue, poetry, beer, and much, much more. If you are in the Knoxville area and you want to support Sundress Academy for the Arts, get your tickets soon. I can't tell you if they're gone yet or not, or if there's still a few left, but of course you can find out all the information about the barn raising party and the shindig and how awesome it's going to be by going to the Sundress Academy Facebook page. Just type in Sundress Academy for the Arts in your search bar, and it will be found. All right, now, ladies and gentlemen, on to today's episode, because it's a good one. We sit down with the one and only Emily Capitini. She is on the program at last, and it is a delight to have her and talk of many a thing with her. We get into literature and classic literature, the books that we hate, and much more, but a quick warning for ya. This episode does contain spoilers for the Netflix series Stranger Things. If you have not watched it and watched it for all 8 episodes and gone from beginning to end, I'm just giving you a heads up right now that around minute 20 or so in here, we start talking about it and we give away one of the major spoilers of the show. So if you have not watched it, yeah, you might want to skip over the section, you know, like maybe a 5 to 10 minute discussion in here. But if you feel confident and you're okay with it, then you can keep listening with no problem. But, of course, spoiling Stranger Things isn't the only thing we talk about. As I hinted before, there is much more to come at you. And as I said, I do not know where the bee is in this room right now, so I'm going to shut up right now and run for the hills. But first, let's hear the theme song.
Yeah, oh. I can hear you.
Sweet.
There we go. It's in my headphones now.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that. I had some weird Skype trouble going on.
Oh, that's okay.
There was a time when Skype was really popular. Now it's kind of not.
Yeah, I think that was like when I was studying abroad in France. It was how you called home.
Cheaper that way?
I guess so. I'm not really sure what's replaced it.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess maybe buy a burner phone on international? Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. It's been a while.
I know. I think it's been since AWP.
Maybe. I don't know. Were you at the SAFTA New Year's?
Oh, that's when it's been since. I was at that.
Yeah, because I was like, no, it hasn't been over a year since I've seen you.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
SAFTA New Year's.
Nothing like it. And that came out derisively. No, there's just nothing like it.
Well, the hangover lasts a few months, I think.
And then we start planning the next one.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that. Yesterday, I was just thinking, I was like, okay, what am I going to do for the SAFTAcast New Year's promo this year? Yeah. How you been?
Pretty good. I just started the new semester. My first day of class was Wednesday, so hit the ground running 3 times a week teaching and 3 different preps, which is exciting because none of them are comp or public writing. Mm. So
you don't have any of those this semester?
No, I'm only teaching creative writing and a lit course.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
What's the real difference between teaching comp and teaching creative writing?
Well, it's a lot murkier just because in comp, there's not really like, everybody has their own style, but it's all like academic, and creative writing is so much lighter, that you're trying to think like big picture. And also like, I'm trying to get them to talk about writing as writers, as opposed to talking about writing as like close reading and things like that. So I've been trying to get the conversations to be like, let's talk about the craft of this story.
Yeah. Obviously we won't talk about that here.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'll save that for the class. That's boring.
Right.
Exactly. So I'll kick this off then and really get into it by asking you kind of a related question, but not exactly. I can't believe I've never asked this as a burning question on everybody's mind. Mm-hmm. But it fits. First week of the semester. Students have this impression that we English teachers love every book ever written. But no, we do not.
No.
So what is one of those like English teacher, like highly lauded, highly praised by seemingly everyone books that you absolutely hate?
I can't stand John Updike. You know, I tried, especially during my my comprehensive exams, I tried to read, I think, maybe 5 or 6 John Updikes, and I just hit this point where I was like, oh my God, I can't take this anymore. You know, he just really can't write good female characters, and then the things that his characters are worried about, I can't like suspend my own opinions and actually like feel sad for, I'm trying to remember the name of the main character in Rabbit Run. Like, I just, oh my God. I'm sure there's a lot of value in it, but I just don't see it.
I know the feeling. I tell my students all the time, because many of them read it in high school now because of the movie, I can't stand Fitzgerald and The Great Gatsby.
Oh, really? See, that's one I like. But I respect your opinion, because I think I read that early enough that I was like, oh, yeah, that is really hard. It's tough life in the Jazz Age.
If I want to read about rich people acting like idiots, I'll read the news.
Yeah, no kidding.
Same goes for, well, not, I don't want to say it, but yeah, I feel bad, but I don't really care for Jane Austen.
Oh, yeah? It took me a while.
How did you come around on Austen? Maybe that would help me.
Oh, I read Northanger Abbey. After I read a few gothic novels, I read that one. And it's just, you know, it's one of her young novels, but it was published, I think, after she died. And, you know, I'm not an Austen expert, so I apologize to those in the audience that are maybe cringing, but she just really goes for it to make fun of the gothic tradition. And I love the gothic tradition because it is so absurd. So it's really fun to have another novel where someone's kind of really having fun with it.
Good idea. I might have to check that one out. Yeah. Cause I've only been exposed to like the big ones, and I was like, boring.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't read Emma. I love Clueless, but I can't read Emma.
What's your take on Moby Dick?
You know, I haven't read it in full. I've read parts of it. And I think I would like to read it, because what I have read of it, I mean, it's, you have to really be paying attention to it at every moment, which is exhausting, especially since it's so long. But I do kind of like what Herman Melville is doing.
I spent too much of my time on other media.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm just more interested in like Frankenstein or the like sensationalist novels like Lady Audley's Secret, you know. I love the Victorian panic. It's so fun.
What's fun about that to you? What do you find so amusing about it?
Oh, gosh. Just the, like, complete... it's like anxiety, the novel, where it's like, okay, the worst case scenario immediately is the first thing that is actually right, right? You know, like, you know, when you're sort of an anxious person, you're immediately like, okay, how badly can this go? And then you kind of think like, okay, that's what's going to happen, even if that's not, you know, necessarily true. But then novels are the, like, Victorian panic novels are kind of like that in a novel.
They think the worst thing, and it turns out the worst thing is what happens.
Yes. Like, I don't know if anybody's read The Monk. It was like the first gothic novel, and it's just this like complete, like perfect storm of all the worst things that could possibly happen. Like, people end up related. There's like a ghost that's a nun that starts haunting someone. The Spanish Inquisition shows up. It's amazing. I have to highly recommend it to anybody listening, because it's just like, you think, you're like, okay, and it's going to slow down a bit. And then there's like something else that crops up.
What book was that?
The Monk, Matthew Lewis.
Okay. I might have to check that one out. I'm always interested in messed up stuff.
Oh yeah. It's I think like the best way to characterize the Gothic novel is that it's just one step back from completely absurd. So it goes right up to it and then it pulls back like at the last minute.
There are the books though that go that one step over the line though and become ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that must be skill then in the Gothic to pull back at the last second.
Yeah, you have to admire it. Just where's your line? Where does it become completely unbelievable?
I gotta get the readers to the point of I am about to throw this book down, and yes. then make them not throw it down. Go, that's yes. it. I'm out. Okay, a lot of professors I've talked to also hate Catcher in the Rye.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that one?
I don't like it either. I think I maybe would have liked it if I had read it earlier, you know, when I was sort of 15 and in that, you know, that angry place that only 15-year-olds can be in. But by the time I read it, I was 17 and I didn't really understand what Holden was upset about, you know, and it was sort of just like, everybody's a phony and he's mad about stuff and he's been kicked out of school. And I don't know. I just didn't get it. And it was funny because I read it in my high school American Lit class, and we had started the semester with The Scarlet Letter, which I loved. So I remember one of my friends coming up to me and being like, oh my gosh, Emily, isn't Catcher in the Rye so good? I was like, oh my God, I can't stand it. He just keeps complaining and saying everybody is a phony, and I don't really understand why everybody likes this book.
I had the same reaction, even though I was at the exact age that and feeling the exact thing that Caulfield is feeling. I'm like, mm-hmm. I wanted to punch him, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know, you know? And a lot of people love it, so what do I know, right?
I felt the same way about The Hobbit, too.
Really? Oh, I like The Hobbit.
Because we read that in, like, 8th grade, 9th grade, I think. And
really?
I didn't care for it. And then I guess I just never cared for Tolkien in general.
Hmm. He is a bit academic, I guess I would say, which, you know, makes sense given his main career. I liked The Hobbit. I thought it was kind of fun and cute. I wasn't that big of a fan of The Lord of the Rings. I liked the second one, which is the Two Towers. But I just remember the last, which is funny because then my favorite movie is actually Return of the King. I just remember the other two being kind of a slog, being difficult to get through. That said, have you ever read Naomi Mitchinson?
No.
I found her by accident at AWP. I was at the small beer press table. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's something else. It is published by Small Beer Press. They have an imprint called Peapod, which is publishing sort of children's classics that have gone out of print.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out about her and this imprint through NPR had an article about her. Like she lived to be, gosh, 100, I think, or a little bit older. But she was a contemporary of Tolkien's. She was one of the first people to read The Hobbit and give him feedback on it. And she wrote just tons and tons of works, but sort of got forgotten. And the one that I read that I loved was called Travel Light, which is about Hala, who is a princess cast out by the stepmother, and then she's taken in by her nurse runs away with her, you know, to save her, and the nurse turns into a bear, and then she ends up being given to a dragon and is raised by dragons, and then she meets the Allfather and like kind of travels through time.
Huh.
It's really good. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. You know, when she meets the Allfather after she has left or been forced to leave the dragon, and she's wearing a lot of his gold. And the, you know, Allfather, which is, you know, Odin, of course, tells her to travel light, which so she sheds everything and takes his cloak. And then that's what permits her to travel light.
Almost like Tolkien stole that a little bit. Now that I'm thinking of it, what a little I remember of The Hobbit and everything. It's like, wait a minute, he can't steal the gold, so he steals the ring that turns him invisible.
Yeah. Well, let's be generous. Perhaps it was the writing community
Perhaps.
Being supportive of each other.
and you know, there was Tolkien was part of that group that used to be in a bar, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is an apocryphal story or not, that he brought in like an early copy of The Hobbit, and his friends were like, this sucks.
Oh.
It needs revision, dude.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I'd have to look into that. If it is, it's a great story. But
yeah, if it's true, those are good friends because they're right. Everything needs revision.
And it's a great example for teaching students about creative writing.
Right. Right. You don't write the best draft first.
No one does.
Right. Who is it that oh, I'm blanking on her name. The woman that wrote shitty first drafts.
Oh.
She also wrote Bird by Bird.
Oh, Anne Lamott?
Yes, Anne Lamott.
Yeah, that people are like, well, Allen Ginsberg said, you know, first thought, best thought. I'm like, do you know how much he edited these pieces? Come on.
Well, there's not necessarily saying first thought, best thought doesn't mean that you can't edit it. It just means that your first instincts on how to tell a story are good.
But don't worry about getting it right on the first time.
Right, exactly.
The only time that works is for grocery lists.
Or if you're Shirley Jackson. Took an afternoon walk and then sat down and wrote The Lottery.
And you're like, damn it.
I know. Oh, she's so good. I can't be mad at her.
No. I've met a couple of writers in my time who, yeah, it seems like they hand you their first draft and you're like, where do I even begin critiquing this? Like, it's just too good.
Mm-hmm.
I hate those people.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate them in the best way possible, you know.
Right. You hate them in a, this is really good, and I love it, and I love you, but also, I hate you a little bit.
Stop making all of us look bad.
Mm-hmm. Stop being so good.
Why can't you just hand in a crappy poem for once and remind us that you're human? But, yeah, there's a lot of books I can't stand or just never really cared for. So, but there are the ones, though, that I love. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Obviously. But the students have this image of us like, oh, you must love all old literature. Hell no.
Yeah. That was one of my favorite things about teaching early American literature. So I taught a couple of sections of that when I was in grad school, which was great. I was really happy to be able to teach them. And also worked out pretty well in my favor because my concentration was not early American literature. But, you know, when I was being asked what I could teach, I could say those because I had taught them. Nice little benefit there. But one of my favorite things to do was to be like, okay, well, let's talk about how ridiculous this work is, right? Let's be realistic here. So I would teach John Smith, which he wrote in the third person, right?
Mm-hmm.
these great stories that showcase him as this wonderful person, you know, and so I'd be like, all right, let's talk a little bit about, John Smith and how absurd he is. And also, you know, the not so funny parts about it, which is that this was a, you know, really horrible thing that happened mm-hmm. to Native Americans. So, you know, we'd start there. We'd talk about the absurdity and we'd talk about Pocahontas and then he'd be like, actually, and then, you know, talk about the realities of it.
John Smith is North America's first action hero.
Oh my God.
He is John Rambo completely. And I love reading how absurd he is. Like, I slaughtered the village and then rode away on a canoe.
Yeah.
I'm just awesome.
Yeah. And then of course the whole like, okay, how much of this is true, which is, you know, probably not very much. And then it's a good way to talk about like advertising too, right? Because these are all written as a way to get people to move.
Come to the new world. We have violence and fish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's all we got.
Yeah. And it's also really good to, I found that it's, it works really well to pair him. Well, not pair him, but I also used to, I would teach Bartolome de las Casas as well. You know, and an early colonizer, but then, you know, kind of came to his senses and realized what horrible things were happening and became an advocate for the Native Americans. And wrote a lot of these journal entries about how horrible the colonizers were. And I think that's really good to teach because sometimes we fall into this trap of like, well, people didn't know better. And then it can be like, yes, they did. Look, I have proof.
It's worth tearing down, you know, the marble persons in literature. Like, and, you know, when I teach Whitman, I'm never afraid to say Whitman was also a bit of a racist.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
For all the adulation he gets, yeah, we got to bring that. But it's also important to bring – it's always important no matter what to bring in the other side.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Because I think it's really helpful. I mean, it's critical thinking, first of all, to put it in the most basic way possible. But it's also, I think, good to be introducing that idea, because sometimes it is the first time it's introduced to them, of like, yeah, your favorite is problematic, you know, and to really kind of look at how, you know, this might be considered a really good work of American literature, but you have to think about like what the kind of suffering and you know, horrible things are behind it. But does that devalue the work or does it just change it? You know,
everything you know is much more complicated than you mm-hmm. think you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, Poe has got some great Gothic stories.
Mm-hmm.
Poe was an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And
a prankster, which is the way unexpected.
Speaking of characters in early American Lit, I think it's Hawthorne wants to beat up Poe, or Poe wants to beat up Hawthorne.
Oh, probably.
You want to get into a bar fight, basically.
Yeah.
But then Hawthorne's his own problems.
Yes. God, he's totally fascinating, though,
I
terms
love him.
Of being incredibly complicated.
Oh, yes. Like, hey, I like you hippies. You're a lot of fun. Let me come live with you. This sucks. I'm leaving and taking my money with me, but I'm going to get a book out of this. And
then
he becomes the old man writing letters to the editor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I hate everything now.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's so much anxiety that you can see in, like, the relationship with his wife, or, like, the like how he felt about feminists or Margaret Fuller, right? And that kind of, like, comes out and in his stories in really interesting ways, too.
Yeah, Hawthorne's an interesting character of this story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I love teaching American Lit. Like,
yes.
There's so many amazing people.
Yeah. Let's talk about how crazy complicated
everyone
all
is.
Of literature is.
We don't have our noses in books all the time, though, so.
Definitely not.
Let's get into, you know, some other things of it. You know, what other media do you gravitate toward when not digesting the Gothic novel? Or do you go for the Gothic in other things like movies or television?
Kind of. I don't necessarily go towards the Gothic in movies and television very frequently. I did just finally watch Stranger Things, which, you know, is more 80s science fiction horror movie than Gothic.
What was your take on that?
I really liked it. I felt, and this is a spoiler for everybody, I felt pretty sad about Barb. I like that inversion of, like, the sensible person being the one that's taken. You know, usually it's the other way around. I think a lot of us really identify with her. You know, the series is kind of centered on those nerdy kids in the basement playing Dungeons and Dragons, right? Don't quite fit in, and then there's the bully. And I feel like Barb is sort of a grown-up version of that. Like, she's kind of awkward. She doesn't really get along with Mike. Is it Mike? No, that's the brother. Who's the love interest?
Steve?
Steve, yes. She kind of gets along with Steve. She doesn't really get along with Steve's friends, right? And she's watching her friend get involved with Steve and thinks it's a bad idea. And I think I think a lot of us have really been there. I think that's why Barb is, you know, so popular with people. I definitely was watching it like, oh yeah, I've been here before, Barb.
Yeah,
obviously not the ending, luckily, but
yeah, obviously not her fate. I wonder if it's more, is her death a shocking one? And we're gonna make sure at the beginning of this show to put a spoiler tag on this.
Okay, good.
I'm gonna make sure of that now.
Yeah, I ended up watching Stranger Things because I found out she died, and I was like, damn it! Now I have to watch it so I don't, you know, don't get spoiled for anything else. Although I think it's pretty obvious once she goes
that
she's coming back.
I don't know if she is, though. When they do season 2 or 3, do you want her to come back?
I don't know, because I think that if she comes back, she's going to be like a monster. I don't know. I'd have to see how it worked out.
There's a part of me that doesn't want her to come back, and it's not anything against the actress or the character. It's that I am tired of Resurrection for fan service reasons.
Yes.
I want her death to carry over. I would love it if in season 2, her death is still traumatizing them.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think that is something that maybe goes unexplored in media, where somebody dies, and too often it's kind of pushed to the side.
See that? I was just talking to somebody about that, especially in comics.
Oh, yeah. I was actually just thinking of the Avengers movies. I was saying that.
You know, I don't want it to be like, oh, well, you know, we're sad, but don't worry, he'll be back next season.
Yeah, it's difficult because on the one hand, it's not the popular thing to do, but on the other hand, there's so much more narrative there. And I don't know if we get a lot of exploration of what trauma is and what it does in media. That's actually, so move us a little bit away from comics and media. That's one of the things I really like about the character of Severus Snape in Harry Potter, as well as all the other, like Dumbledore and Voldemort and Harry, because I think that Rowling is one of the best writers out there actually exploring the different ways that trauma manifests for different people.
I was about to ask, are there other really good examples of that, of where there is a character death maybe early in a series or even late, and then the hangover continues in the characters? The only one that comes to my mind is Full Metal Alchemist.
Oh, yeah.
Where, oh, death, yeah, right. Where death is really important to the character's psyche going forward.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's like Trigun is like that, too.
I haven't really seen Trigun, but then...
Really?
Me and anime, we have a torrid history.
Do you?
Yeah. I'll just keep it short.
Okay.
The fan base made me not want to get involved with the genre for many, many years.
Okay.
And it was only when I met my wife that she made me sit down and enjoy a couple. And I'm like, okay, I can deal with a couple of these.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of it, but some of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that. I'm not always into the popular anime, but you know, there's a special place in my heart for the ones that initially got me into the genre.
How did, you know, what is your story with it? Because I know that, you know, from knowing you a little bit, I know that you do have a history with the animation.
I do. Let's see. I think it started with, it must have started with Sailor Moon. It definitely did. I remember watching it after school before it was transferred to Toonami. And my friend Laura was really into it. And I actually didn't have cable when I was growing up. I had it like a little bit when I was about kindergarten age, but then afterwards we didn't have it. So I would have to, she'd have to tell me what was going on. And then I'd go over to her house and watch it sometimes, or she'd sometimes record it for me. And then I really did. I loved Sailor Moon, but then I was like super into Gundam Wing, which is kind of when everything spiraled out of control. And I ended up, you know, saving the money and getting the VHS tapes and, gosh, then it was Trigun and briefly Dragon Ball Z. I think everybody has a brief Dragon Ball Z phase. Oh, and so, you know, I was also very much into magical girls. So Cardcaptor Sakura is one of my favorites. Still is. I just reread the whole manga series, I think, last month.
Nothing like going back on a reread.
I know. It's still pretty good. It holds up. I was impressed.
I know nothing of it.
Okay. It's... Let's see. So she's 13, I think, and it starts with her going down into her father's basement and opening a book, and all of these cards go like flying out of it, and it turns out that they're like magical cards that control, some of them control elements, and then some of them are like the sword card, where it's a sword that can cut anything, and so she has to go and like gather them all up and seal them away, you know, and then she's like normal 14-year-old girl with crushes on her older brother's friend, and some other guy shows up and is her rival for collecting the Clow cards, and it's all this intrigue and stuff. It's very good.
There's something amazing about it. There's something very attractive about it, and I'm not talking about, you know, for those of you who think I'm creepy, no, it's not the characters. It's the concept of, the Spider-Man concept of, here's this young person dealing with forces bigger than they know, and yet also still trying to live a life.
Oh, yeah. That's why I love about Sailor Moon so much. You know, she's... I've talked about this before, where she's just such a typical middle schooler, where she's like, I don't want to get up early and go to school. And then she's always late. She hates doing her homework. And then it's like, oh, but you have to save, you have to save the world from these ridiculous monsters that are taking over cruise ships and draining energy and, you know... sort of killing people too, right? There's something going on with like crystals and people's hearts or...
And all that, yeah.
Yeah. I just love the contrast of it, where it's like, okay, yeah, normal stuff things that everybody panics about, and then it's like, oh, by the way.
It's like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, too.
Yes. Oh, I love Buffy.
A lot of 90s properties I missed out on, and I've since now tried to do my best to catch up on them and go, oh, yeah, so that was going on when I was a teenager.
Neat. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's good timing since the 90s are back.
Indeed they are, for better or for worse.
Because I don't know if I'm far removed enough. Like, I don't know if it's been a long enough time that I would be able to recognize 90s genre as opposed to 80s or early 2000s.
I don't know if there's any 90s properties I want back. Can't think of any. I mean, no, just got nothing. But then, as I said, those were my teen years. I was sullen. Didn't matter.
Yeah. Everything's terrible.
Everything's terrible, man. And I definitely don't want that coming back.
Yeah. No. Everybody should just leave that moment. Being a teenager was, you know, fun in a lot of ways, but there are so many things where I'm like, no way. Don't ever want that back.
The only thing I want from my teen years back is less responsibility of the world.
Yeah, yeah. I could go for not having any debt.
Totally understand. I'd be okay with that, and I'd be okay with things like not having to pay as many bills.
Yes, yes.
But where were you a teenager? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago. I say that because not many people know what I'm talking about when I say Batavia. That's my hometown.
I think Batavia, New York, immediately.
Oh, yeah. There's Batavia, New York, and there's several other ones around, but that was my hometown and, you know, close enough to the city that you could go in for a day, but not frequently.
You were born in Batavia or the nearby area?
Yeah, I was born in the area. I lived in Texas for a little bit when I was a kid, but most of my time was spent there.
Texas was where family was, or did your parents move down there for a time and then come back to Illinois?
Yeah, we just moved down there for a few years and then came back to Illinois.
Was it just you and your parents, or were there siblings as well involved?
Oh, I have two older sisters.
How much older?
5 years and 8 years. Yes, I am the baby of the family.
Probably got on your sister's nerves a little bit.
What are siblings for?
Exactly. Well, speaking as an only child, I have no idea. That's why I ask.
That and also having your back when you need it. I don't want to be too pessimistic.
Especially, you know, maybe you're still close to them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have a really good relationship with my family.
But you've lived around a lot of places then.
I have.
from Illinois, where do you go?
Well, after I did my undergrad, I went to Louisiana to pursue a PhD in creative writing, and I was in Lafayette, which is in the western part of Louisiana, southwest. After that, I moved to Baltimore for a year, and after that, I went to Knoxville, Tennessee, and now I am in Indiana.
So you're winding up kind of close to home then.
I am, yeah. It's pretty nice. I'm only a few hours away from my hometown.
Family must like that.
Mm-hmm.
Back in your
finally can attend birthday parties
and holidays,
Christmas.
Are you happy being back close to home, or are you kind of like, I wish I was a little bit further away?
Oh no, I'm really glad to be this close to home.
Something about the Midwest that calls to you?
Oh yes, yes. The cheese curds call to me. Seasons call to me. Oh, I'm so excited to actually have an October that feels like the Octobers that I grew up with. You know, Louisiana, it would be 80 degrees in October, and I would be so mad.
I know what you mean. I haven't been home in New York in 10 years in the fall, and it breaks my heart.
Yeah. Do you get foliage changing down there, or is it just always green?
Always green.
Oh, God. I can't do it. Like, I'm very happy for the people where they love that, but I can't do it.
I mean, yeah, I miss the change and everything, but I am also not going to complain about walking outside in short sleeves and shorts in January.
That's true. That is the nice trade-off. Because by the time it's March in the Midwest, I'm like, oh my God, I don't want any more snow.
I'll take a little bit in November, a little bit in December. After that, to hell with it.
Just some festive dusting.
So of all the places, though, you mentioned going to France and everything. Have you been outside the country much?
Just a couple of times. When I was, after I had graduated high school, there was sort of a trip that you could take. They did it every other year. So, for example, like even years were the French trip and odd years were the Spanish trip. So you'd either be a junior or a senior when you went, if you'd been doing that language all through high school. And so since I had, and I actually have I had a French major when I was an undergrad, I decided to go to France. It was like about 2 week tour of the country. And then when I was in college, I took advantage of the studying abroad program and went back for 4 months. Yeah, 4 months.
Where were you in Paris? I mean, where were you in? Brain locked. it's been a long week.
I could tell you where I visited in Paris.
where in France were you?
Well, I was in Cannes, which is on the Riviera. So most of the year it's a retirement community. And then about mid-April, tourist season starts up. And then there's the film festival in May, and the population triples.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Cannes is known for.
Yeah. It's very beautiful. You know, I couldn't complain because I was staying at a college, which was a language school, and it wasn't really on the beach. There were some train tracks in front of it and a road. There's a road that runs along the shore in Cannes, but it was like you would take a 5 minute walk and you'd be on the beach. So that was pretty nice. And I felt, you know, very lucky to be able to spend a time in that part of the country. I don't think I'd ever be able to afford it again.
Was that while you were in high school or was that in college study abroad?
That was college.
Where was the high school one?
I think we did about a week in Paris total, kind of went back and forth. And I also remember being in Lyon and Sarlat. I believe we also went to Avignon and Nice. Oh, and Chamonix, which was stunning. That's the little town at the base of Mont Blanc. And also, it's fun to say.
Mont Blanc.
Chamonix.
Chamonix. Have you been just in France or have you been throughout Europe?
Oh, no. I couldn't really go anywhere in high school, any other countries. But when I was in college there, I was trying to get to as many as possible. We did go to Florence on a weekend trip, and I also went to Switzerland and Ireland. I spent my spring break in Ireland.
Not necessarily the spring break place that I think of in America. It's like, yeah, I'm going to Ireland.
Right, right. It was not a beachfront. I think that's the tradition, right?
It's a resort town.
Yeah. Oh, and we had a stopover in London on the way in.
So what did you do for spring break in Ireland?
We started in Dublin and we rented a car, which, you know, that sounds like it would have been a disaster, but actually the friend I was with that was driving the car, she adjusted so well. I was really impressed, you know, because it's the opposite side of the road. So before anybody starts panicking, we were totally fine. We had a flat tire, I think, in Cork, and that was really it for drama. I did slip and fall in some mud, I think, on the West Coast. I don't remember what I was doing. But so we spent a few nights in Dublin, and we tried a couple of the pub crawls. My favorite was the literary pub crawl. They took you to all the bars that had associations with the literary folk of Ireland, so like Yeats and Joyce and all those people. And then we went to Galway, which was my favorite part of Ireland. And then we went down to Cork by way of Cove and wherever the Blarney Stone is, that might be Cove.
I'm going to trust you on this one.
Okay. This was also about 8 years ago, so I'm I'm really pulling on my memory here.
The Saftacast, where we really plug your memory.
I didn't know there was going to be a quiz about my college study abroad. I would have brushed up.
Well, I mean, we don't have to talk Ireland. We can drift anywhere we want.
Right.
In terms of topics. So it's just, we followed in that vein for a little bit. We can always move it into some other direction, such as, I don't know, the fall season. What are you looking forward to most this fall? Beyond changing of the season, is there something specific you look forward to in the autumn time?
Apple cider donuts and apple cider. Those are my...
Apple cider donuts?
Oh, yeah. Have you never had them?
No.
Oh, they're so good. You have to find some. When I was a kid, we did this a lot, but there was a farm, I think about 20 minutes from my hometown, Kuiper's Farm. And you would go out there, you'd pick out your pumpkin, and you'd get a hot cup of apple cider, and you'd get a donut and walk around. And it was always pretty chilly when we were out there, so the cider was great. You know, you'd be cold, and then your mouth would be burned because you'd be drinking the apple cider, but, you know, didn't care because it was so good. As an adult, now I buy, you know, a bunch to take home, but as a kid, my mom was like, I only have one, which is probably smart. I'm not sure if, I'm trying to remember, I don't think the recipe is that complicated. I think they're baked rather than fried, and they have like a cinnamon sugar coating on them, like dusting.
Maybe use apple cider instead of water or something.
Yeah, I think that might be it. But yeah, I love that's one of the other things I love about the Midwest is, you know, being able to go to a farm and, you know, pick out your own pumpkin or pick your own fruit or apples or whatever. I've been looking a lot into CSAs here in Indiana. I think I'm too late to really join one, but there's a few farms in the area that I can go drive to and shop.
What's a CSA?
I can't remember what it stands for, but you put down some money. It's usually like $300 to $400, and you get like 12 weeks of produce from a farm.
Huh. That sounds like a kick-ass idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's, you know, they'll usually deliver it to a central location, you know, because they can't really go around dropping it off at people's places. And you never really know what you're going to get. It's just whatever they've been growing. And so that kind of like mystery produce intrigues me, and also, you know, locally grown produce and support, you know, local farming and all that. But yeah, you have to really be inventive because you might get like a lot of zucchini squash and they have to figure out what to do with it.
Here's some rhubarb and onions. Go right to town.
Rhubarb compote with caramelized onions.
Bingo. Done. You're kind of knowledgeable about cooking.
I try. I'm not as, it's more of a hobby interest. So, you know, I don't know that, I think there's like six sauces you have to know. I don't know those. I know one of them is a cream sauce.
For me, it's always just been, here's gravy. Mm-hmm. That works. That's a sauce.
Yeah.
And marinara. Those are the two for me.
Oh, I'm not a big marinara fan. You know, it's too sweet for me.
I'm one of those people, I can't stand raw tomatoes, but processed, I'm okay with.
Okay.
But I don't understand. I don't know why I hate raw tomatoes. Just can't abide by them.
Well, you know, have you had heirloom tomatoes?
I've tried many a tomato. Okay. And I just can't deal with it. Same with pickles. I've tried multiple pickles and I can't stand pickles.
Scott, I don't know what to say to this. Those are two of my favorite snack items.
I'm sorry. I've tried different types of pickles, different flavors, different styles, and every time it's the texture for some reason. I can't deal with it. Are there foods that you just cannot stand on that level?
Not really, actually. This is where I'm a bit unusual, but there's not really a food I don't like. There's foods that I don't really get. Like I don't get the sort of obsession over lobster. I like lobster. I think it's fine, but I don't really get why people are that crazy about it.
I always feel a little disappointed with lobster.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like there's not enough of it mm-hmm. when I eat it.
Yeah.
It's like all that work and for just a small amount of meat in the tail and claws.
Yeah. I can't make that argument because I love crawfish. See what I'm talking about? There not being enough of it in the actual tail itself.
But you make up for it in crawfish by sheer volume.
That's true, yeah.
It's like, yeah, there's only a tiny, tiny bit of meat, but here's 100 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, brain froze.
No, totally fine.
It happens. It's like I said, it's been a long week, and it sounds like it's been a long week for you as well, starting the challenges of every new semester starting, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
It's like suddenly, here are 90 to X number of people you've never met before.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got to, like, find a connection with them almost immediately
mm-hmm.
while handling 100 other things and going, oh yeah, but I still have to do things like take garbage out. invariably there's a lot to handle.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So how do you de-stress? You know, how do you unplug from work?
Well, I've been training for a half marathon not very well, I have to admit. I fell a little behind on my schedule. But I like to go for runs just because it clears my head. I sleep better. I worry less when I'm sort of diverting the energy that way, as opposed to, you know, worrying over things that I don't really have control over.
When did you start taking up running?
I started doing it in grad school, and I would run outside, which was, you know, if anybody has ever spent a year in Louisiana, like I was serious. You know, I'd run in the evening, but it would still be like 98% humidity and, I don't know, 90 degrees. but you know, I had to take that, I had to get rid of that energy somehow. And so I decided that I was going to start running. And then when I was in Baltimore, I picked up yoga. When I was living in Baltimore, I was working as a barista, which was a very stressful job. And I needed a way to de-stress, but like it was more important almost. I'm trying to think of how to articulate this, but like the stress of the barista job required like a more serious, like direct attack on my stress. So, I started going to hot yoga pretty regularly, because in yoga, you have to clear your mind and focus on the movements. And then in hot yoga, you can't really think about anything else except don't fall on your face.
What is hot yoga exactly?
Well, it's like regular yoga, except the room is like 95.
I'm just thinking to myself, like, why?
Well, like I said, you know, my mind didn't wander as much because one of the downsides to hot yoga is, you know, because you're sweating, things get slippery. Usually your mat won't get slick if you've got a good one because it's got a texture on it. But if they wanted you to do like tree pose and you were wearing shorts, so tree pose is when you take the bottom of one of your feet and put it in your standing and you put it up onto your thigh and it's a standing balance pose.
Okay.
If you're wearing shorts, you can't really keep your foot on your leg.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, that's why people wear yoga pants. I realized that pretty quickly. That even if it's that hot, you have to wear something that gives you more traction.
Okay. So did you take up yoga before you took up running, or was running first?
Running was first.
Mm-hmm. And then the yoga. What was stressful about working as a barista? I'm curious because from the, you know, someone who drinks a lot of coffee, I can see the stress of it, but what specifically is the stressors of it?
Well, you don't really have any downtime. You know, you're constantly working, and, you know, you have to constantly be prepping and thinking ahead and thinking of what you're going to do. And that's also a customer service job, so it comes with all of those,
wonderful,
all of those stresses.
Wonderful perks.
You know, and it's, I don't want to paint it as it being a horrible job. It, you know, it wasn't.
Unexpected stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there's the joke, you know, there's always those jokes like the Friends episode where Rachel goes over and hands someone a drink and then like lists off all the qualifiers for it. It's like, I know, extra hot, non-fat, with whip, like just all this stuff that kind of, it takes her about 30 seconds to see the whole drink. And the reason that's funny is because that happens a lot. Like there are those drinks out there.
Then I'm proud to do my part to help the baristas by being a simple man with simple tastes. Yeah, can I get just a coffee with cream and sugar?
I remember the first time somebody ordered just a latte, and I was like, oh, is that all? Okay. I was so used to like getting ready for the milk and the, you know, whipped cream or whatever.
Does it change your opinion when you go into?
A little bit. I don't really order like specialty lattes anymore because I don't really like sweet things that much. You know, I like chocolate and I like darker chocolate. I don't like milk chocolate very much. And then when I'm stressed out, I eat gummy bears, but like that's kind of it for me. So I don't really like sort of specialty lattes because there's just too much syrup in it for me. But then I'm just kind of like, I don't really want to be that. I don't really want to like order this complicated drink. Like I go in and I'm already tired, I guess.
I'm exhausted. I don't have the energy.
Which is funny because that's kind of like what my attitude was before I was a barista. Just like, oh, coffee shops is so tiring.
It's like, I don't have the energy to list 7 different qualifiers on this drink for you.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's hot and it's got caffeine, I'm cool with it.
Right. I think if I really liked a certain drink, I probably wouldn't feel that way, but there's nothing that really appeals to me. I'm really just kind of a cafe au lait person.
Simple and plain for the most part.
Yep. I just want some coffee with milk. That's all I want. Maybe a pastry. See how I feel.
It's hot. It's good. Whatever.
I'm not a pumpkin spice latte person. We're going to go into controversial subjects.
It's like I've had it and I went, it does taste a little like a pumpkin.
Yeah.
Whatever.
It's fine. Yeah.
Have you noticed there seems to be almost a small backlash now toward the pumpkin spice movement?
Oh, yes.
Are you part of that backlash?
No, I'm really of the opinion that if you like something, you know, if you like something that's like, you know, safe and legal, you know, like the normal parameters, I'm not going to judge. You know, like, what do I know?
Is there a point where it goes too far, though?
Pumpkin spice M&Ms. That's my line.
Bring it back to Gothic. It's like, how far do you go over the line, you know?
Pumpkin spice M&Ms and Swedish fish Oreos. It's too far.
Wait, they make Swedish fish Oreos?
Oh, yeah. It's a new limited edition flavor. They have them at the Kroger here.
That's it. I'm out.
Yep. That's my thing about dessert is I just, you know, if too many flavors can really ruin something. So I'm actually, you know, like I'd rather have fruit or chocolate. I don't necessarily like fruit and chocolate. I'm very simple when it comes to that stuff. I will say I do enjoy Trader Joe's pumpkin toaster pastries. I look forward to those coming back in the fall.
I'm starting to see it creep in already. It's like September 1st. Everything turns into a pumpkin spice.
Oh, yeah. I think that's actually when they start serving the pumpkin spice lattes at Starbucks.
Which is funny because where I'm in Florida, PSL, they have it on the sign on Starbucks. It's like, we have PSL again. And I'm like, the town I'm living is abbreviated to PSL.
Oh, that's funny.
So I find it hilarious. I'm looking at the sign. I'm like, really? You have what's already here? Cool.
It sounds like there's a good advertisement opportunity that they're not taking advantage of.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. What has happened to Oreos? You bring up the Swedish fish Oreos. And just as a side note, I'm of that era where there was only one flavor. Two.
Actually, that era.
They had mint flavor for a while, and that was it.
Oh, yeah. The mint. I like the mint. You know, I was the kid who didn't really like double stuff Oreos. I'm not actually a huge frosting fan. I never have been. But yeah, that was, I remember those being like the new thing.
Oh yeah, the pink one. It was like the pink one, the green one, and regular.
What was the pink one?
That was double stuff, yeah.
Right, that was the
packaging, yeah.
Right. Took me a second.
It's okay. It's like I should have clarified. But yeah, there were only those three. And now they have all these limited editions. I don't want that much variety.
What's wrong with the original? It's not broke. Don't fix it.
If they're limited time anyway, it's not like in 20 years I'm going to be, bring back that one Oreo flavor you had for 2 months.
Maybe. This is probably, yes. What's the cultural atmosphere that, you know, encourages Swedish fish Oreos?
But a lot of things are happening all over the place. A lot of things happening with you as well. In the future, you know, you recently got an essay come out, you know, through Queen Maup's Tea House.
Mm-hmm.
And congrats on that, by the way. I encourage our listeners to go check it out. It's a great essay, I thought.
Thank you. It's called Extra Life. Anybody that doesn't know how to spell my last name. It should be on the main page, though.
You can throw a link up on the post here.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah. I encourage you to check it out. It's a great way of combining video games with your life and discovering who you are.
Yeah.
What else you got coming out in the near future? Are you kind of working more focusing on teaching or something else right now?
Nothing pending right now. That was actually – so the essay had a really quick turnaround. It was accepted on Monday the 15th, and then it was published on the 22nd. And I've been working on other stuff. Am I allowed to talk about my writing?
Yeah.
Okay.
By all means, we're in the moment here. Promote yourself. Tell us what you got going on.
Well, I've been working a lot on urban legends and engaging with those. And I'm a big fan of looking at old narratives and finding new ways to tell it. particularly if it gives voice to previously marginalized characters. And one of the things, and this is something that I discovered while I was working on the farm, which was, you know, Saunders Academy for the Arts, the artist residency, and realized that, you know, I've always been really interested in ghost stories, which is funny because I'm actually kind of a wimp. So, you know, I binge watched Stranger Things and then I was sort of freaked out a little bit. not too bad, but I tend to get kind of like jumpy after I watch horror stuff. But I realized that I like ghost stories for their, you know, the narrative richness of them and the fact that there is sort of like, I love history. So the like history kind of being combined with like local stuff and then like also cultural things, which so that those are all things I really like that kind of are distilled into one story. And so I was thinking a lot about urban legends and particularly ones that have a certain place. That said, the first one I wrote was about Bloody Mary. So it's not really place-based. so I've been looking at that. And then I was thinking a lot about Resurrection Mary, which is a Chicago vanishing hitchhiker. And started to realize that like a lot of these ghosts are women and a lot of them don't talk. So then I was like, well, what happens when they talk? So I've been thinking about that. I've been working with a few of those. Both of those stories are out being shopped around, seeing if anybody bites. Then, with that in mind, I actually sort of self-deprecatingly referred to my writing as Women Who Vanish. And then I thought about it later after I had been writing a story about Amelia Earhart. And I was like, okay, maybe that was a pretty accurate way to put it.
So hopefully we'll see some new work from you. A couple of short stories, maybe, who knows, coming out in the near future.
I hope so.
I hope so.
One of my other nonfiction pieces is out too about, it's called How to Be a Preteen Anime Fan in 1999. Mm. So we'll see if anyone's interested.
Your book came out through Omnidawn?
It did, yes. Last November, I was very excited to have my little novella out in the world. Another ghost story, another story about, in which the ghost is a woman who's been silenced. And then of course, the main character is in a relationship that's kind of muffling her too. Mm. So that's a different take on vanishing.
Definitely encourage our listeners to check that out. I've had the chance to read it and it is fantastic.
Thank you.
It is truly a delight to read and truly a delight to have you on the program, Emily. For the folks at home, where can they find you online?
Well, you can find me on Twitter and my username is Polycocktail.
And of course on Facebook and beyond. Mm-hmm. So definitely encourage our listeners to check you out. Emily, it is always a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, likewise, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for having you here, and feel free to come back anytime.
Okay, I will.
Something happens, let's just get on the mic and talk about it.
Right. Well, you know, next time, if you want me to talk for 20 minutes straight about Doctor Who.
That's a good point, you know. Although I think it would be a one-sided conversation.
Yes. I could give you some research assignments.
Maybe. I might have to take you up on that. I've tried.
All right.
I've tried on a couple of episodes. I'm like, okay, I see the appeal, but...
You know, again, as I've been saying, I understand when people like stuff, even if I don't like it. So I think it'd be unfair if I expected you to like Doctor Who.
But, you know, maybe we should try sometime, you know, have an experiment here. But we'll see, indeed, how that goes. But Emily, thank you for being on today.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
You too.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.